Welcome and good morning to those of you who are stalwart enough to be here at 8 o'clock. I'd like to welcome you to our devotional session this morning, and the remarks will be given by John Armstrong. John is a PhD student at the University of Arizona in philosophy, and his specialty is ancient Greek philosophy. And he is the past editor and publisher of Student Review, and let's get started.
The title of this exegesis session is, Were There Genders in the Pre-Existence? Before we get started, perhaps I'll explain what I take an exegesis to be. It's simply a careful interpretation of a passage of Scripture, trying to find out what it means. Okay, so what our priority is going to be here this morning is to try and figure out what this passage of Scripture means. We're going to try and free ourselves as much as we can of our theological baggage and before we try and interpret it. We're going to try and let this passage tell us what it means before we try and tell it what it means. Okay. What I'll do is I'll read through the handout. I expect we'll have some time afterwards, and I'm sure there's going to be lots of questions which will reach beyond this particular passage of Scripture about the issue involved. And I'll be happy to repeat them in the mic and we'll discuss. This passage is part of the record of a vision given to Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon at Hiram, Ohio, February 16, 1832. This is Doctrine and Covenants 76, 22 through 24. And now, after the many testimonies which have been given of him, this is the testimony last of all which we give of him, that he lives. For we saw him even on the right hand of God, and we heard the voice bearing record that he is the only begotten of the Father, that by him and through him and of him the worlds are and were created, and the inhabitants thereof are begotten sons and daughters unto God. This passage has been cited as evidence that we existed as sons and daughters, that is, as gendered children of our heavenly parents in the pre-existence. Okay. By reading this reading verse 24, the last bit, in context, however, one can see that the agent doing the begetting is the only begotten of the Father, i.e. Jesus Christ. Okay, so there's a problem here if we take this as evidence that we were sons and daughters, as this verse as evidence that we were sons and daughters in the pre-existence, because, as I'll explain in the exegesis, the agent doing the beginning is the only begotten of the Father, okay, not God the Father. The clause, the inhabitants thereof are begotten sons and daughters unto God, unquote, is a syntactically complete sentence and expresses a complete thought. What thought does it express? Part of the answer depends on how we understand the words unto God. For those who take this verse as evidence of pre-existent gender, God here seems to mean God the Father, and unto seems to indicate that God is the one who did the begetting of the inhabitants of the worlds spoken of. This interpretation is not right. Even if God here refers to God the Father, unto does not indicate agency. Rather, unto means to. If God were the one doing the begetting here, we would expect by rather than to. Okay. The context of the clause does give us an agent of the begetting, however, because this clause is connected to the text above it by an and, we can look there for the agent. We see that this clause is not the only complete clause in the paragraph. The words, the worlds are and were created, is also a complete clause. The words, the worlds are and were created, is a subordinate clause, however, subordinate to the words, we heard the voice bearing record that by him and through him and of him. I should have put an ellipses there. It seems to me that the most natural reading of this verse is to take the words, "The inhabitants thereof are begotten sons and daughters unto God," also to be subordinate to the same words which the worlds are and were created, excuse the typo, are subordinate to. In other words, they're both subordinate clause, and they're subordinate to the same main clause. And that main clause is the words, "We heard the voice bearing record that by him and through him and of him," and then we have two subordinate clauses. And both of them are complete sentences in and of themselves, but they happen to be syntactically subordinate. Okay, otherwise, the last clause of the above citation, that is, the words, "The inhabitants thereof are begotten sons and daughters unto God," is left hanging without any clear syntactic, let alone theological, connection to the text above it. By taking "the inhabitants thereof are begotten sons and daughters unto God" to be subordinate to "we heard the voice bearing record that by him and through him and of him," it immediately becomes clear as to who is doing the begetting. The inhabitants of the worlds are begotten sons and daughters by and through and of the only begotten, i.e. Jesus Christ. If this sounds like an odd doctrine, compare Mosiah 5:7, where, whoops, King Benjamin says, you can tell I typed this out quickly at the U Library. "And now, because of the covenant which ye have made, ye shall be called the children of Christ, his sons and daughters. For behold, this day he hath spiritually begotten you. For ye say that your hearts are changed through faith on his name, therefore ye are born of him, and have become his sons and daughters. Therefore, only if we were begotten by Jesus Christ in the pre-existence is D&C 76, 23-24 evidence of antemortal gender." Okay. Now, that's my exegesis of this passage. Perhaps one question that's left hanging is, well, what do the words "unto God" mean here? What are they doing? If Jesus Christ is the one that's done the begetting of the inhabitants of the world in this passage, however that's done, you know, we could take it to be spiritually or literally or however, what do "unto God" mean? What does "unto God" mean? Well, if it means to God, if they're begotten to God and not by God, well, the picture that must be in mind here is something like Christ, you know, begets us and then says something like, "Here you go, God." That, I mean, they're begotten to God. It's like handed over to God. That's how I understand it anyway. It seems to be something of a stretch to say that "unto" indicates agency, that it was that God there, if that's God the Father, that did the begetting. This is the only time in all instances in the Scripture of the word "begotten" that there's this particular phrase, "unto God," after the word "begotten." Okay. So we don't have any scriptural precedent or other example to help us understand what "unto God" means here. So my guess is, based on the meaning of the word "unto," that it's just something like handing over these children to God. Okay, questions about this passage? Yes?
Could "unto" refer to the mother handing the children over to the father?
The question is, could the "unto" refer to the mother turning the children over to the father? Well, it could, taken by itself. But since we have the rest of this verse here, it's clear that Christ is the one that did the begetting. The only begotten of the Father is the one that the inhabitants thereof are begotten sons and daughters by him and through him and of him, right? So it's Jesus Christ who did this begetting. It's by him, through him, of him. So I don't know. I mean, is it the mother turning to the father? I don't know. There's no evidence here that that's the case. Yeah.
The word God is used in two places in the scripture, and in the one case it's the son standing next to the God.
Okay, that would give us some clear indication that it would be God the Father then, the latter instance then, wouldn't it? God the Father, or, you know, or if God signifies both heavenly parents, then, you know, both of them. But, yeah. Okay, good. Any other questions about this? Linda?
Well, in the second passage, it seems to me that the begetting that takes place is in the mortal existence. Is that a correct understanding?
That seems to be the case. I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. When did this beginning take place? Right. The question, the point is, the Messiah verse seems to indicate some kind of spiritual begetting that takes place in the mortal existence, whereas, and it need not have taken place in a premortal existence.
And that could be true in the first passage, in, as well, if we read it in relation to this passage.
Yeah, you mean that the first passage could be referenced to a spiritual begetting. Right. Yeah. I mean, I included the Messiah 5:7 passage because here's Christ as the Father, and we are referred to as sons and daughters of Christ, not of the Father. And so I just wanted to give an example of how that may not be such an odd doctrine if that's how we're going to construe D&C 76. Did that? Okay. Yeah, sorry.
In that first reference, and the world's armor created seems to be all inclusive, and the inhabitants there, the begotten, is inhabitants all inclusive?
All inclusive? You mean.
All inhabitants?
Yeah, good question. It doesn't say all the inhabitants thereof are begotten sons and daughters unto God. It just says the inhabitants thereof are begotten sons and daughters unto God. Well, I don't know. Does it make sense to say that only half or a fraction of the inhabitants were begotten by Christ? I guess it could make sense to say that, but it seems to me that sort of the general sense of this is that it is all the inhabitants. I mean, we could press and say, look, you don't have the word all in there. So maybe it doesn't mean all, but I don't know.
It sounds like he's drawing a circle around all to me.
Yeah.
With the word thereof.
Well, thereof is referred to the world. So the inhabitants of the world are begotten sons and daughters.
It'd almost be redundant to say all.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he could have said, some of the inhabitants thereof. That would have made perfect sense. But
isn't Messiah talking about some?
I don't know.
Only those whose hearts are changed.
Yeah. You know, we want to be careful not to read too much from Messiah into the D&C. But it's certainly possible it's just some. Anyway, back here, yeah. Okay.
Fatherhood, because in that, it's the kind of, we're begotten sons and daughters because all of humanity are begotten sons and daughters of God, of the Creator, who
sets this
world in motion.
Right.
And it's a different kind of begotten sons and daughters in the Bible, where we're spiritually begotten.
The point is that the Messiah passage could be referring to a spiritual beginning, which happens at some kind of conversion point in individuals' lives. And the D&C passage could be referring to the fatherhood of Christ in the sense that he, in virtue of being the creator of the universe, is our father by us being part of the creation, though he may not be actually the one who threw together the elements of our spirit or whatever. Yeah, well... It says the inhabitants thereof are begotten by him and through him and of him. By him, that seems pretty strong. Anyway, let's come back to this question of the gender. Okay. Now, if you take this as, when this passage is used as evidence of antemortal gender, this last clause is just quoted by itself. The inhabitants thereof are begotten sons and daughters unto God. There you go. Pre-immortal gender, right? Not really. If you read it in context, it's Jesus Christ doing the begetting, which makes it sound odd that you're going to be defending a doctrine of the pre-existent gender, and it turns out that Christ is the one that bore you. So, only if Christ bore us in the pre-existence is this evidence of pre-existent gender. And then you go, well, I thought it was, God the Father who did that. Well, anyway, I conclude that this is not evidence that, or not straightforward evidence, that there is pre-existent gender. Is there other evidence in the scriptures that there was, that you can think of? Okay, there's a passage in Job, right? Let me read it. It says something like, well, it does say, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. God questioning Job, where were you, Job, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. The word here for sons is bain in Hebrew, and it's in plural, bainim. And I looked this up in a theological, it's called the Old Testament Theological Word Book, and it says in the plural this can refer to children of both genders. Now, does that give us evidence that there was premortal gender? Well, what's the alternative? If there wasn't premortal gender, then what? Well, the alternative is either we didn't exist in the pre-existence, or we were sexless. Okay. Now, the second alternative is intriguing to me. This verse, may just refer to some kind of sexless children of God the Father. And if you think about it, what's the point of having sex in the pre-existence? Anybody got any ideas? Bonding. Well, let me give you some other passages. If one was going to construct an argument that there were genders in the pre-existence, the natural place to turn, I think, is Moses, where there's in Moses, the beginning of the third chapter, there's a verse that says, "For I, the Lord, created all things which I have spoken spiritually before they were naturally upon the face of the earth." So there's apparently a difference between the spiritual and the physical creation. He just got done talking about, apparently, the spiritual creation, where he says, I, God, created man in mine own image. In the image of my only begotten created I him. Male and female created I them. Okay. And that seems to be referring to a spiritual creation, that they were created male and female. Okay. Now, there are some complications with that when we get in later in Moses, the sixth chapter, where Adam is recounting the creation story, and he says, "In that day that God created man in the likeness of God, made he him. In the image of his own body, male and female, created he them." And you think, wait a minute. Male and female in the image of his own body? Created he them? Well, that seems to give us some kind of clue about some kind of funny body of God if it's male and female, In the image of his own body, male and female, created he them and blessed them, and he called their name Adam. In the day when they were created and became living souls in the land upon the footstool of God. Okay. Called male and female, called them Adam, and they're created in the image of his own body. Anyway, that's a puzzle. about, you know, if we're going to defend the idea that there is premortal gender and take this as evidence of it, suddenly we were faced with the situation of trying to explain God's gender if we're created in God's image. Okay. Well, Sharon. Sorry. Well, if this is referring to spiritual creation, then it seems to.
Why do you think it refers to spiritual creation?
Well, the idea was that in Moses 3, he says, I created everything spiritually before I did naturally upon the face of the earth. And then a couple verses before that in the text, it's at the end of chapter 2, we had the familiar verse, I created man in mine own image. In the image of my only begotten created I him, male and female created I them. And it seems from the text to be clearly that part of the text is a description of the spiritual creation. Sharon?
But if there is a need to be created male and female, it would create something that was already existing.
Well, okay. Aha. Aha. If there were a need to be created male and female, then he wouldn't have created something that was already existing. So, Sharon, what were we before we were created male and female? Well, I'll speculate a little bit.
I don't know. I haven't really thought about it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
John, I'm wondering if we're getting ourselves into a fundamentalist conundrum.
Like what?
Well, in terms of taking the creation quite so literally, in terms of the Pilgrim Fronts, and fighting the language rather than feeling it in terms of poetry, as we talked about in devotional yesterday, rather than, well, these are the actual words that came from God's mouth through the papyri to Joseph Smith, right to us. And perhaps it, you're trying to answer a question that is, number one, unanswerable, but number two, that is so literal in terms of the scripture that it can be confusing, really confusing. But one other issue that in terms of, at least in terms of feminist writings, gender is a social construct rather than sex. And I think what we've been talking about.
Oh, well,
yeah, if we had gender construct as we know it now in a pre-existence, you can do away with it.
Okay, two points she's making is, one is, why be so literal about these things? And two, am I making a point about gender or sex? And shouldn't I be taking into account feminist arguments about the construction of gender? Well, to answer the first, I'm doing an exegesis, and exegesis is a very strict interpretation of Scripture in the words. Okay, so, and I'm generally, you know, if you want to answer a doctrinal question, I don't really give much credence to if someone's going to do an interpretation of Scripture, their poetic reaction to something. I want to know what the words say and what they could possibly mean. That's why I argue against the DNC 76 passage as being evidence of pre-existent gender, because if you read it carefully, the syntax of the sentence gives us the agent of the begetting as being Jesus Christ. Now, so, you know, I'm literal there. I'm being literal. So what? You know, I mean, if we were more literal, I think we'd be able to do away with a lot of pernicious doctrines. But people aren't literal enough because they, you know, some people can't read very well. So anyway, that's my hobby horse there. Now, about the construction of gender, well, I don't know. I don't want to get off in a big discussion about cultural norms about gender and stuff. But what I'm talking about is, you know, whether you had a testes or ovaries. That's what I'm talking about here. And those things, to me, don't seem to be socially constructed. So, well, anyway, that's my response to that. Yeah.
You expressed some concern over male and female being created in the image of the Father's body, but it seems to me that it could take, you know.
Well, it says God's body, not Father's body.
God's body. It seems to me that it could take, you know, the overall form of the body about the details of the sex. And the, I mean, we are all built in the form of a human being as opposed to a dog or something.
Right. Okay. So there's a loose sense.
That strikes me as George Orwell's statement that all are equal, but some are more equal than others. All are like God, but some are more like God than others.
Yeah.
And people get excluded from being most like God are women.
Right. What did Scott Barchett say last night? If you want to be like Jesus, you have to be like Jesus.
Yeah. That depends on whether God is the couple or the father.
Yeah.
But that's the point.
Well, let me.
If God is the Father, then males are more like God than females.
Well, let me give you something else to speculate about. See, this, the argument here, at least the Moses bit about pre-existent gender, is based on the idea that God created our spirits. Now, in the King Follett discourse, Joseph Smith emphatically denies that ever happened. Okay, and he uses the word spirit and he uses the word soul, both. So if God, now let's assume that Joseph Smith was right 2.5 months before he died, that God never created our spirits. Okay. But then what? Were we gendered forever before? Just from the beginning of time we were gendered? What's the use? Well, why would we be? We might think. Another thing that you might want to think about is that some, I've looked up every instance of begotten in my little scripture search program of the scriptures. And as far as I can tell, begotten is a term used for the Father begetting the Son and Jesus begetting us. Okay. Created is the word used for God the Father doing us whatever he did. Okay. So, and that's interesting, I think. Why created for God's creation of us and begetting for Jesus begetting of us? Why a difference in terminology? Those are interesting questions too. But anyway, we have to leave it there. Enjoy the symposium today.